You're listening to Mischief Media.
Hello, patient extraneous listeners.
Good evening.
You are the most patient.
You really are. We appreciate it. Assuming there's any of you left.
Hello.
I'm sure there will.
Hello. Into the cave.
The wind.
Welcome to Extraneous HDM. We are so sorry. It's been a minute. As we've said a couple of times on this podcast, the pandemic has changed our schedules quite a few times in this.
Schedules and other things, life things.
We're in a patty lapone, and that has meant some wacky schedules, and we've been doing our best to get back to you, and we're so sorry it has taken so long.
Yeah, but we're back now.
I'm Melissa.
I'm Will.
And we are your hosts of Extraneous His Dark Materials, where we go deep on the story and come back with stuff that you didn't know before. It's been a minute.
Yep. It's where we go deep on the stories you love and come back with a little something extra.
Will has a better memory than I do, okay? This week, we are doing chapters 9 and 10 of Amber Spyglass. So we are going to be, to give you a little recap, we're going to be doing two or three chapters at a time of Amber Spyglass until we are through the book. We are not going to immediately go back and do the prequels, because first of all, they're still being written. The prequel plus the sequel, they're still being written. And then in the maybe summer or fall, we're going to be telling you what we've decided to do next.
That's right. We have some ideas. We have some amazing things coming soon. So stay tuned, including hopefully regular episodes again. Yeah, man, it's been rough. But yeah, so we are really looking forward to you finishing Amber Spyglass, not ruling out the first trilogy, you know, down the road, or the little extra story that he wrote, the novella about
the lantern slides.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Yorick and Lee. We will absolutely be doing the show when it comes back, Amber Spyglass season 3. We will see if they commit to doing just the one season for the book or they split it up. But either way, we will be your companions through it all, the good and the bad. Yeah. So whatever we end up doing for the second half of the year, we have not forgotten about the coming show, and we will be pausing to go back and do all the deep dives on the show too.
Now, as you may have heard from the opening of this here PCast, we have a new little audio bug. We don't even have to say anymore you're listening to Mischief Media, because the audio bug does it for us. Technology.
Yeah.
That was Jordan Edwards of Mischief going, "You're listening to Mischief Media." Let's play it again right here, because it's super
fun.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Mischief Media.
But this is a Mischief Media podcast, and you should go check out everything else that Mischief Media puts out.
Okay, so we are jumping into Amber Spyglass chapters 9 and 10. We are right in the thick of the big stuff here.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
Do you remember who did the summary last?
Do you? All right, so here's the question. Do you feel up to doing it, or would you prefer me to attempt it?
I would prefer you to do it. I feel up to it. I don't like not
oh, no.
feel
yeah,
up to
sure,
it.
Sure, of course.
It's not like a challenge for which I cannot prepare myself.
It's like it's not like I can't do it. You know,
but
I just
offered
don't,
I mean, me to.
I totally could do it. I'm just. Okay. So as she pulls up the clock, and as I do a little stretching, do a little.
He's limbering up.
Yep.
Limbering up, y'all. Ready?
Ready. Yorick and Will are on the boat and they're going south, and Yorick is asking about the knife because he doesn't really understand the knife, or like he does understand the knife, but he doesn't understand his understanding. We'll get into it. And then they land and all the bears go up into the mountains that I'm pretty sure are the Himalayas, and Yorick and Will kind of start their journey to find Lyra, and it's just very cool, and there's like music gathering in the background of like, here they come. Meanwhile, Father Gomez is interviewing our least favorite kids, Angelina and Paolo, and it's just a big like bad, like it's just a total suck fest. It's like, we hate them, we hate him. He's asking about Lyra. They're saying bad things about Lyra. It's very foreboding. And then he takes off through the silent, sad city. And it's very ominous and bad in general. Next, we get to the Gallivespians, who are just effing everywhere. They're like, they're in the rafters of the Zeppelins that are coming to kill Lyra, but also Lord Asriel's Zeppelins are coming to save Lyra, or his gyropters, which is like almost a cool word to say. And then you actually say it and you realize it's like missing a syllable. Anyway, it's like there's a big confrontation coming. It's like all the armies are gathering. Everyone's like on the move in this chapter, but they're heading towards Lyra and they're like communicating with their lodestones and their, you know, smoke signals and all that stuff. So meanwhile, Mary is having the time of her life hanging out with the Muffly Bumps, and she's learning about their language, and he's learning about like how they do their society and how it's all like very balanced and Edenic. And we'll get into that too. And then these like the worst birds ever attack and just ruin everything. And that's when we get into this foreboding, like, but the trees, which are the secret to everything, were actually dying and the world itself was in trouble. End of chapter. End. Fade to black.
Okay, so that was 2 minutes and 13 seconds, which I'm actually cutting off 4 seconds because, so it's 2 minutes and 9 seconds because mm-hmm. the first 4 seconds were, okay, which I get it. No,
block.
But that's like, we're getting back into the swing and that was a perfectly, so 2 minutes and 9 seconds.
Okay.
All right, so let's start with our epigraphs. Want to read the first one?
Yeah, so the first one is an Emily Dickinson fragment, again. It's a shade upon the mind there passes as when on noon a cloud the mighty sun encloses. So
Emily Dickinson, famously sunny.
Right, so confession, we didn't do a deep dive on this one.
So this is about the chapter where they're moving through the hills and they're trying to find Lyra. This is in front of that chapter.
Right.
And it's the chapter with the gyrocopter, right? The gyropter?
Yep.
Wow, there is a missing
syllable. You want to say like gyrocopter or
really
something?
Really badly.
It was gyropter and it's like,
Almost. Mm. So a shade upon the mind there passes as when on moon a cloud the mighty sun encloses. I think it's getting to these pre-language thoughts that are so big that it's similar to what looks like a shade that's covering the moon, but it's really, it's just like a cloud that can cover a sun. Like it's like the illusion that this, when you reach that Keatsian, that state that we always talk, is that Keats?
Yeah, Keats, the negative
capability.
Yeah.
That alethiometer state. It's that kind of like when an idea hits you in fullness and you haven't put language to it yet, but you know it's there and you know the fullness of it, even though you, have you ever had this experience? I'm
sure I have, yeah.
When the wholeness of an idea hits before you start picking it apart and you can feel all its implications, but before you start putting words to it, which automatically limits it, it's like saying the bigness of connection and the bigness of those thoughts is like when you see something covering the sun and it's just a cloud because of the distance.
Yeah.
Does that
the
make sense?
Pre-articulate.
Is that the word? Like, is that official?
There's a Seamus Heaney line, "Our war stalled in the pre-articulate." It's just, I don't know, brought to mind what you were saying.
Yeah. I think about the pre-articulate a lot.
Right. Especially because you like to rush towards the fullness of a thing.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. We're already done recording this podcast. I'm just goal-oriented.
You are.
So the beginning of the thing is the most frustrating to me because I can't get it out. So this actually reminds me of that idea. It's like this thing hits you and it's so big that it may seem small, but it's actually...
It's so funny that you say that and that you're getting to this, because I get something different from this, and we'll get that in a second. But sometimes you are so excited to get to articulate something, you will leave out words.
I do.
And it's not. It's like she's a published author. Like you are plenty good with words, but you're just so excited for like the thing itself. You don't have time to like.
I leave out words, like keywords too.
And I'm the opposite. I'm like so plodding, like.
Get it out. I smack them.
So that's really funny. So I interpreted this as just danger is coming. It's like, it's because it's the setting of high noon, and then there's a shade that passes over the sun.
Looking at this again, that seems like the more correct iteration.
I like yours too, though.
Listen, poems sometimes bring up different connected thoughts, and that's valid. I'm not going to like devalue a thought that a piece of art brought up. They're always valid. But I think that probably you're closer to what that is actually implying, that it looks like it's a cloud, but it's probably a war.
Yeah. Like there's something coming.
Something's coming.
A cloud. But, you know, you don't put an Emily Dickinson fragment in and expect for total clarity because that's not really her jam.
Really poetry always.
Yeah, that's true. But she was, yeah. In her tiny little house in Amherst, Mass. Not so tiny, actually. I think we've both seen it. Everyone's seen Emily Dickinson's house if you grew up in New England.
Will grew up in New England. I'm not sure if you knew.
Have you heard it grew up in Massachusetts?
All right. Our second epigraph is, there ariseth a little cloud out of the sea like a man's hand. It's from 1 Kings chapter 18 in the Bible. In the Bible, as it was.
Yo Bible.
Will knows more about what it's about.
Michael Bible. Yeah. So this is about the prophet Elijah. And I only know this because we looked it up. I did not know this off the top of my head. I think this is about Elijah kind of coming into his own as a prophet. So Elijah is sent to God, to the kingdom of King Ahab. We know Ahab from Moby Dick, but before it hit, the reference, I think, is to this king who's like done the usual Old Testament thing. You know, he's like, he's given his kingdom over to the worship of Baal and the worship of idols, and everyone's decadent. Everyone's like having a great time. And then makes God pissy. One interpretation.
Sure.
And so he sends Elijah, and Elijah does all these kind of miracles, and the people are slowly being convinced that, like, oh, the power of the Lord is real, and Elijah is the prophet. And so Elijah calls on God to make it rain, I think, essentially. And six times he, like, sends his servant out to see, like, is it raining? And the servant comes back, he's not. And Elijah, like, is persistent in his prayer, and his he has faith that God will make it happen. And the seventh time he goes out, and this is what the servant tells Elijah, says, there arises a little cloud out of the sea like a man's hand, and this is the rainstorm that is rising out of the sea to come down upon the kingdom of King Ahab. And that action is what convinces King Ahab that Elijah is truly a prophet of the Lord, and that the Lord is like the one true God and all that. And Elijah kind of comes into his own as a prophet. So you and I think have a similar interpretation of this, that this is about Mary. First of all, it's about Mary, and it's about Mary like being patient and persistent
and having her inspiration moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like talking to the I Ching and saying, yeah, like, be patient, be still in your
trust and faith. Yeah. And she realizes why she's there and exactly what her purpose is through this.
Yes.
Get into our characters.
Yeah. So
start with Will.
Mm-hmm. So Will, not a lot of like character arc here, but Will is sort of like in recovery, and it's like Will is gaining his strength back. And I think it's a transitional chapter for him, but it's an exciting one because we see him when he gets off the boat and he's like climbing it in the foothills of the Himalayas with Yorick, who is a real like spiritual partner to Will, I think. You know, their outlook is very similar. You know, both reluctant warriors, both very capable warriors.
Do a shot. Melissa's about to make a Harry Potter reference. But in the seventh book, there's a lot of hullabaloo about, oh, they do his camp and walk around, because it feels like that's what they're doing a lot of the time, because it's so repetitive that they're like camping and it's kind of dreary, and that kind of sticks in your minds. That happens in a lot of adventure stories. Actually, I'm watching Critical Role right now, and the audience is really, some of the audience is really annoyed that they're taking like a long time to kind of like get to their big chase moment. So I'm realizing that this is a pattern. And in this story, that is Will's hand bleeding as he stumbles on for life. Like there was so much of that in book two. And now that he's had the blood moss and he's had some time to rest, it feels so nice to see him fully up on his feet, relishing an exercise with a partner in ability or preternatural, whatever kinship they find with each other. It also says he didn't realize that he was on the last reserves of his strength, but Yorick did. Like Yorick knew immediately that this kid is not only really special and he's Lyra's friend and I need to take care of him, but oh boy, he needs some rest.
Yeah, right.
He is at the end. So yeah, Will kind of gets his reserves back, but it's always nice when you see a kind of big draggled character like buy some food, get good shoes, get a coat, be on their way. They got clear directions that, you know.
Yeah. It's like in Witcher
walk
when
with
you.
Purpose. Yeah. The shopping episode. The shopping episodes always feel so good when they're earned.
It's like in Witcher when you go back to Hierarch Square and the topmotch swords guy And you sell all your stuff and get your stuff repaired and you rest up and you replenish your potions.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Replenish your potions, visit the general merchant and be on their way.
Sell your books, convert your currency.
But Will also has a couple of interactions with Yorick about the knife. And Yorick is presented with, if we want to like kind of like bridge over to Yorick here, is presented with a whole new puzzle and challenge for him to figure out. And he spends like days or something touching and moving and listening to the way the air goes over the knife.
Yeah.
Studying it so close, Will thought he'd cut his eye. And he's just... And Will never wonders for a second that he will hurt himself because of the delicacy of his giant paws.
Yeah.
And so, for Yorick, this is kind of a big moment. We also get a lot of backstory about what's happening with the bears.
Yeah, definitely. We do. And they're like, they're following Yorick, but they're confused a bit and they're worried. But Yorick, like a true leader, is saying like, listen, things are going to have to change. Be prepared for some strangeness, my bears. You know, but like it's temporary and it's what we need to do to survive, that they are going to the Himalayas, essentially. The Himalayas are a stand-in for him, for the Himalayas.
Yeah, they're supposed to be sea bears, but they're going to be mountain bears. They just need to be where blubbery animals live so that they can kill the blubbery animals and eat. Like that's just pure survival. But to do that, he has to live among men, hire a crew, follow the melting currents because climate change has screwed up this whole world. Follow the melting currents until they can't go anymore and they charter a ship.
Yeah.
And they head towards, ironically, where Will is going.
Yeah, it just happened to work out that way. I do love what Philip Pullman does, what you were saying with all the things he does to the knife. Like listen to the wind as it blows across it and look at the edge real close and like listen to it when he like taps it. And like it's just, it's this whole like world of knowledge that Philip Pullman is making up. And he doesn't have to provide any specifics, but you just get the sense that like the bears understand metal in a way that's just deeper than we do.
You're also a sucker for a craftsperson.
I love it. I really do.
I have so many questions about the knife. It always says that one side is one metal, one side's the other. Where does one stop and start? How come, like, are they melted together? Do they meld together? Can the type of metal that can cut worlds be melted enough to meld with the magnesium that's the alloy that's the other side? That's like the side.
Right.
I have, or maybe the magnesium alloy is the world's cutting side. Whichever one. How did this knife come into existence? I have so many questions.
Right. But well, it's a very much, yeah, it is. It's mystical. But it's like the Aquinas thing of like angels on the head of a pin. It's like it's the edge of the knife, but on an atomic level, where does the edge begin and end?
Right. So at what point does the knife bleed into the other side of the knife, which is just for cutting things like fingers?
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, right.
Like just fingers. My question. And Yorick, after studying this knife, just sort of in that classic taciturn Yorick way, puts it down and says, I was right. I could not have fought this.
Yeah. There's a profundity to it, a finality to it.
It also amps up what the knife is from even what we already knew. It's one small knife versus a bear made of sky metal, iron, you know?
And that, I do like that because I think you and I have both wondered, like, how are you going to fight the angel armies of the Lord with like one little knife? Like, yeah, you can cut anything, but like, if you cut what angel, won't the other ones just like, what if one has a, like, what if they just shoot you with a gun? Then how will the knife protect you? And so we don't get a lot of details on that, but we get some idea of like, even Yorick recognizes, I could not have fought this.
Yeah.
Even though in our heads, practically you think, well, Yorick, we've seen Yorick move much faster than humans like can even see. What if he just like ran behind Will and cut Will's head off? Like that shouldn't difficult, but there's, I don't know, there's something mystical or there's something more to the knife than just the practical combat aspects.
What else about Yorick?
I think that's about it.
It hasn't had a lot of change. He just spends time with Will and they're off to get Lyra. He also points out his hierarchy of needs, which is interesting. He says, I will first do what is important for the bears. I will second do what's important to save Lyra. And I will third do what's important to honor and avenge Lee Scoresby.
Yes.
He like lays it out. He's so rational and logical. He's like, this is my decision-making tree.
Yeah.
You can apply what comes of it.
Again, it's like good leadership.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this is what matters.
Well, and I was actually surprised to hear that the bears came above Lyra, actually.
Yeah, right?
I think he says that's what his needs are, but as long as it doesn't come in conflict with the bears, he's going to do whatever he can do to assist Lyra.
Well, in one sense, his leadership is like sustainable because it's mainly just him by himself. Like bears are mainly like self-sufficient. They just, you know, they come together in times of emergency and war, but otherwise they're just doing their own thing. Doing bear stuff.
Oh, there was another interesting thing that Yorick said. He asked to see the side of the knife that does the world splitting.
Yeah.
And Will says, I can't show you because we're moving on a boat, but as soon as we stop, I'll show you. And he says, I can think of it, but not understand what I am thinking. It is the strangest thing I have ever seen. I can think of it, but not understand what I am thinking. This feels, again, to me like the cloud. So maybe there's another... for the idea of this cloud imagery that hits your mind and you can like feel the wholeness.
To me, it's a very Spock kind of moment.
Right.
Because it's like when Spock is confronted by some more qualitative like human emotion, where he's like, I understand this, but I don't understand how I understand this because it's illogical.
Right.
You know, Yorick is so practical and logical in his thinking. So it's like he's so brilliant that he comprehends what the knife can do, but the problem is like his data is like contradicting previous data about how the world works,
right?
And so it doesn't compute. Yeah, cool. I think that's interesting.
Let's get on to Father Gomez.
Father Gomez sucks,
there's not much. He's pre-forgiven for committing an absolute atrocity.
Yeah, he talks to Angelica and Paolo.
I know think of him as Paola also because of the show, but it's Paolo.
Paolo.
And interrogates these kids about Mary, actually.
Yeah. He's very smart about how he does it. You know, he doesn't bring up Lyra. He doesn't bring up the knife. Like, he lets them bring up all the information he wants without him having to actually ask any of it. So in the future, when they think of him, like, they won't think of him asking any of these questions. He's a good little super assassin.
Jerk.
Reminds me of The Americans, which we watched recently, where they're like, they're so good about never being the ones to bring up the thing that they want information on, but like making sure the other person ends up bringing it up. And so they never remember them as actually having asked any questions about it at all.
So he sucks.
Yeah.
Mary Malone. A lot of Mary Malone this chapter, and we'll get into it more in Dust Bunnies. But Mary has figured out her place in the world.
Yeah, man. These are really nice chapters. Mm-hmm. Or chapter, half chapter. But it's a really nice passage.
She starts to communicate with the Mulefa. She starts to learn their ways. And she starts to figure out the interlocking evolutionary puzzle that is Malefiton, as we have dubbed it.
Yes.
Mary Malone... just decides to hang with these Mulefa for a while and learn about them. But she actually has a chance to consult the I Ching, discover if she's on the right path, if she should be moving. And the I Ching is like, no, you just stay where you are. And in doing so, she puts a big puzzle piece together. And it's a big moment of growth for her.
Yeah.
So that's the movement among our main characters. And we're going to go into our dust bears, which is the
big concepts.
Big sort things. Of themey.
Yeah, it's themey.
Theme adjacent.
It's theme adjacent. Theme adjacent
items.
So our first big dust bear is your friend and mine, the Galavespians. Ooh. Yeah.
I just wooed the Galavespians. You know, I love them so much. I'm like cheering them on in the stadium.
I love it.
And when I first read the books, I'm like, who are these little tiny spies? I hate them. And by the end of the book, I'm like, I will die for the Galavespians.
Yes,
love them so much.
It's so true.
Yeah,
the brief tragic heroic lives
brief
of the Galavespians.
Tragic heroic proud Galavespians. Amazing
gladiators for good. So we get a lot of Galavespian like lore, I guess you could say. Here we learn about the whole thing with the dragonflies.
They carry around these eggs that they turn into the things they ride on.
God.
And they have the ability, the talent, to feed them just enough oil and honey to make them hatch at the time. Because you can't have them hatch before, because you'll get noticed. And you can't have them hatch too late, because you need them for travel.
And they don't live very long.
They live for 3 days, I think?
Something like that.
Oh, no. They don't live for 3 days. They had 3 days to make them come, to make them hatch.
But they live for like a week.
But they're also undergoing this like gestation process while in the back of a gyrocopter?
A zeppelin, actually. A zeppelin. Airship.
That's right. All right. Well, they got plenty of room on the zeppelin.
Yeah. Yeah, it is wild. Philip Pullman, where did this idea come from?
How do you hatch this idea is my question.
Yeah, for real. Each Galavespian clan has their own breed of dragonfly, which have their own specialties. So like one is small and blue and glows in the dark and really fast. Tialis, his family, the Chevalier Tialis, his families are like red and yellow stripes and have brutal appetites and seem almost like war dragonflies the way they're described. There's a whole thing. It is also to me very much a mirror of the Galavespians themselves, because, and we'll get into more about the dragonfly's life in future chapters, but they live, longer than 3 days, I think, but only for a week or two. I forget exactly how long. And so they also are bred to have these lives of service. And there's something sort of sad and tragic, but also heroic about them too. And the Galavespians' willingness to do this, to subject them to this, to give them a purpose, but also like control.
Yeah, they also seem to care for them a lot too.
Yeah.
As the story goes on, you notice that they care for them a lot.
They do.
As well.
But it's like deeply practical.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's meaning to it. It's complicated. Like, is it morally wrong the way they've subjected this species?
Well, there's a lot in this about the difference between species that have consciousness, Sraf. Dust, whatever,
mm-hmm.
versus the ones that don't.
Yeah, there really is. And we talked about this before recording. I hadn't occurred to me that this is like another example of that,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
It is.
Yeah.
And so all of this is even though the Galavespians are like so flagrantly heroic in their portrayal, you know, is this problematic? Like, would the dragonflies much rather not spend their like week or two of life
Or
maybe they don't care.
I think there was a bright dividing line between creatures that have consciousness and creatures that don't in Philip Pullman's world, and he's made it very clear that one are of a higher class and one are not. And I think this is sort of where, if this world was active right now, vegans would be very upset. Vegans mm-hmm. would be incredibly upset. And like that's sort of like, it sort of strikes me like that. I think it's just a matter of perspective. If you think that an animal without quote unquote the same consciousness sentience as, you know, has rights, then this would be a very upsetting
yeah.
point of situation. Or as you think they might have some rights, but they're also part of a food chain, then that's another conversation. You know, I don't know. I think it's morally murky, but I think in this world, there is a very clear structure being set up where one class is much higher than the other.
Yeah. But like we said in the intro, the Galavespians are everywhere. They're on the gyropters, like Lord Roke is on the gyropter with his, you know, his like steampunk walkie-talkie.
Yeah, steampunk walkie-talkie.
Steampunk Snapchat.
It's like a walnut, right? It's in like a walnut shell or it's the size of a walnut shell.
Yeah.
This lodestone. I sort of imagine it like a harp. Or like a timpani drum or something.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know what a lodestone would look like.
I don't either. I thought they played it with a bow, though.
That's kind of how I think. Like some sort of musical instrument that they're just sort of sketching out.
Yeah,
harmonies
it's resonating.
On.
So
yeah.
It's like a...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild. It's again, it's just like, where did this
Where'd
come
from?
Where
did you get from? These ideas?
But yeah, so there's... Tialis and Salmakia are on the airship that the Consistorial Court of Discipline and the Holy Order of the Holy Super Spirit, or whatever it is, are both on. So they're spying. Lord Roke is with Lord Asriel on his, the flag gyropter, you might
with
call
African
flagship.
King Ogunway?
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
They
All right,
say
not
African,
Asriel.
They said Afric.
Afric.
No, not Asriel. It's the King Ogunway.
Ogunway, yeah, that's right. Yeah, so they are like ready for action. They are doing all their very complicated stuff.
Yeah, and they're trying to stop Lyra from being killed.
Right,
there's one of the church is going there to kill her.
Yes.
Azrael's going there to save her. They're all going there to get her. Will's going there to get her. Everybody, the whole world is about to converge
mm-hmm.
on Lyra, and the church is trying to kill her, and the Galavespians are not going to let that happen.
Yeah, and I love the directions that they give.
Mm-hmm.
They're given like the preservation of Lyra's life is a consideration to be placed above all others.
Yeah,
the subtext of that is including your lives.
Yeah. All right, so that's our Galavespian thoughts for the week. Mulefa's
on to the wheelie guys.
Well, or, and like the whole world of Mulefa.
Yeah, yeah.
Learn a couple things. First of all, there are two types of Mulefa, but I guess only one is real Mulefa. There are two types of these animals, people. God, it's so the terminology is so hard. There are two types of these creatures. Mm-hmm. One are the, and they're physically very similar. One is the grazers, where they have diamond-shaped structure, four legs, and they just walk on their four legs and do what they do.
A little awkward.
And the ones that have attached two of those legs to wheels are the Mulefa. And the Mulefa are Mulefa because they have evolved by making themselves one with the oil that comes through the seed pods, which comes into them through their connection with these seed pods. And there's lots of other implications of that. But like, so you have literally the same creatures. Philip Pullman has shown us a world where you have the same creatures, only one half of which has been touched by dust. And that side has society and makes things, and he's very clearly laying out the result of dust.
Right.
But he's also laying out this is something that is connected to faith, that is connected to angels, as we've learned. But now he's making a very direct connection to science and evolution.
Yeah.
Because the dust happens because it's in these seed pods that fall from trees.
Mm-hmm. Which, this, I mean, to be clear, we don't know that explicitly from these chapters yet, but obviously we...
That it's dust?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess not. I guess we don't know that this is the Straff.
But it's
strongly hinted at, because she does talk about how the only difference is really that these are the wheeled, and they're getting what they're getting through the oil, and the oil is sort of permeated their whole structure. So I'm trying to figure out where the cycle starts. The seed pods fall from the trees. At some point, a grazer picked up one of those seed pods, put their claw through it, put the other claw through it, and started rolling. The act of rolling and the natural highways that have existed on this land helped crack these seed pods and therefore germinate the land with the seeds on the inside. And then so that like the tree, by shedding its seed pods, helps itself survive.
Right.
I'm trying to piece this out as I'm saying this out loud.
Yeah, no, I think that's all right.
And then the Mulefa get the benefit of the oil and the fast transportation, et cetera, and they become conscious beings. They start to connect and have society, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the sort of cycle. The tree needs the Mulefa needs the tree. They've all evolved to continue this cycle.
Right. Yeah. Well, you assume over millions of years. So like the seeds slowly probably got harder, or the trees that evolved harder seed pods survived more because those seed pods were more in use by the Mulefa.
And cared for.
And they were cracked. Whereas the trees that didn't evolve the super hard seed pods probably died off and like over...
Or got preyed on. Like, he's very careful to lay out why the harder seed pods survive, as you're pointing out, because if they weren't so hard, they'd get eaten by those birds.
Yeah, and so these variations over millions and millions of years, you know, it's like...
It is such an incredible puzzle that he's put together here.
Yeah, it is. Where it's complex. But it's also, you were saying like before we recorded that it's like all the immediate pieces of evolution are here. Mm-hmm. Whereas like if you walk into a forest now, evolution is obviously happening, and you could say like, oh, that bird has camouflage, or like that seeds have evolved spikes. But there's so many variables because there's millions of things happening at once. Whereas this, it's like there's a road. And there's a creature, and the creature gets the seed pods from the tree and rides on the road. And there's only like a few pieces, so you can actually see it all together.
And then the roads are cared for because the grazers that use them, or the Mulefa that use them, need them. So these naturally forming roads like survive and are part of culture because they need them to ride on. Like, you know, it's like he took away all the excess variables and was like, I'm going to show you a closed circle of evolution right here,
right,
and to show how all of this connects.
A closed circle is a really good way of putting it.
Like a seed pod.
Yeah, like a seed pod. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then literally every piece, because when you first read these books, you're like, what are these things?
Yeah, that was my take. It's like, oh God, do we have to like Are we going to spend pages and pages on these guys?
Right. How much? There's a war. How am I spending time with weird antelopes? What's going on? And it's so incredibly important because it lays out the way his whole faith science thing is interlocked. Mm-hmm. And it's also revelatory and important and lovely. And each little piece of the animal, you can see how he made it. Each little piece is important. The fingers on the end of the trunks that can go from soft to very hard and fulfill.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Various functions. Yeah. And like how they do all things in pairs, which Mary doesn't because she has hands. She has two hands that can do it, and that fascinates them. And she feels like maybe the fact that she can do all these things alone isolates her. And
yeah, like maybe humanity has evolved a less communal society because of the fact that we have two opposable thumbs instead of one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just wild.
It's the whole little snow globe that he's created here is endlessly fascinating.
And Melissa, you have pointed out more than once, there's all of that that's operative and like the science and the evolution, but this is also Eden. Yes. And it's showing like a version of Eden that doesn't depend on like, well, God made everything perfect. It's like things have evolved to work in tandem with each other to create this balance. And that like that is what Eden is. Mm-hmm. And that the fall isn't like searching for knowledge. It's when some element falls out of balance because of greed or carelessness or something like that. It is the story of Eden. Like a lot of people describe Eden like this, but twisting it a little bit, adding a little more of like a humanistic nuance to it.
Absolutely. So they talk about that Eden is dying now because they're perfect. The perfect society. And again, he's created a perfect little world. Everything works in tandem, even the predators. It all works in tandem. And something has shifted it out of balance. So do we think that this is the moment the knife was created? Do we think this is the first fall, whatever that was? Do we think this is just human consciousness? Like, what do we think this is?
So I think we should, first of all, definitely revisit this question later in the book when we know more about what's actually happening.
Yeah.
We only get that like cliffhanger at the end of the episode. Right. They're like, the trees were dying. Yeah, I mean, the invention of the knife could be it, because we're told, well, we'll get into exactly what we're told down the road, but I think that's a possibility. But it almost seems like too simplistic.
Doesn't it though?
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just I don't know. This will be a big question as we...
It's a big question, because then you get into like science is good, but science leads to creation and invention, and that leads to destruction. And you know what I mean? Like,
you want to know what I think it is?
What?
I think it's creation of the church.
Because
and this is spoiler, but when the fall happens in this book, that's what replenishes the quote unquote fall. That the rebirth of consciousness and choice and free will in this world replenishes it. And if forces like the church and authoritarianism, whatever, are left unchecked, is when you're pulling the dust out of the world. And maybe this is a very top off the dome thought. I've never had this thought before, but it could be the kind of like birth of autocratic stuff, the shaming of the fall, the shaming of choice, the shaming of free will, which would seem to align with when the church was created.
Yes and no. Mm. Yeah, because like a lot of what we're told about the creation of the church, or the creation of the authority,
that might be more what I mean.
Yeah,
yeah,
is like, but that is, I think we're led to believe that is so much more ancient than the relatively recent problem of the dying of Malefitinville. But maybe it's taken,
I don't know,
countless eons to reach this like final bastion of...
Yeah. I mean, in this world, the authority is just another angel, right?
It is, yeah.
And so it was like maybe the moment that the authority decided to assert control over others instead of leaving.
But that was as soon as the second angel was created, right? Because the second angel was created and the first angel, the authority, said, hey, I created you.
I created you.
And created the land of the dead and created all this stuff himself,
right.
themselves. Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to explore it more.
Because a lot goes back in these books to those moments, to the first fall, which
right.
I keep talking about the fall like it's Eden, but it's actually the fall of the angel from heaven. Mm-hmm. And even that is beyond, that's the fifth or sixth, 10,000th angel. I don't know. But it would seem to go along with the Paradise Lost analogy that this is when one angel decided to lord over the other. And now we're at sort of, we're sowing what's been reaped.
Other way around, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Reaping yeah. what's been sown.
Right.
A lot of nature imagery.
Yeah.
But also like, it's an allegory for climate change. It's a yes. lot of things. A lot of things.
Yes, it very much is.
Yeah.
It very much is. Like, glaciers are melting now, but the roots of that started, you know, in the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s.
Right. And that's where the knife was created. That seems to be the allegory for when the knife was created a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about it before, about it being symbolic of the industrial.
Yeah, the industrialization.
Yeah. So the Mulefa.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot happening. These are lovely chapters and seeing all these things unfold, but there's just a lot of implications and thematic stuff that's happening behind it. Obviously, we will talk lots and lots more about it in future chapters. But hey, man, muffly bumps. They're actually really important.
Yeah, it's shocking. And them discovering each other. It's
very cool. it's lovely.
Yeah,
yeah.
So let's talk about the new thought that we just discussed before we.
Yeah, you want to jump into this?
Okay, so our next dust bear is the balance of consciousness versus not consciousness in this world, and sort of what I was hinting at before about veganism somehow. So the Mulefa are evolved grazers. They just are a type. I keep saying it's like what if there was a class of humans that had no thought, that were just out there grazing in fields to eat, but like are humans. I'm not talking about the way we think of cows or even the way we think of monkeys. Humans.
Right.
Maybe monkeys, but I'm not sure. But monkeys seem to be sentient and to have, so I don't know where the line is. Yeah. Anyway, this would be like, they look exactly like us. They are exactly like us, except for one attachment that they don't have. We eat them. That's literally, the Mulefa right. in this chapter literally eat them. And I'd never like sort of put that all together. The whole village works together to skin and cook and use every bit of it, but they're doing that to an entity that looks exactly like they do.
Yeah.
To the last piece. And that's not a problem. That's just like the nature of life. It just kind of freaked me out for a minute.
Right. You get the sense that Philip Pullman is saying they have to, because like if the population gets out of control, then the careful balance of this world will get out of joint. And, you know, the Mulefa are like the keepers of that. And right. so they understand what they have to do. And like if they didn't do that, then everything would messed up and everyone would start dying.
Yeah. I mean,
they
need food. Like it's it's not a thing, but it's a little bit cannibalistic. It's a little bit of cannibalism. Is it not cannibalism if they don't have consciousness? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Humans eat monkeys in some places.
But monkeys aren't humans.
No, they're not. But they're humanoid and they're sentient. They're intelligent. I mean, like cows are sentient, you know, like sentience is, there has to be something more than that.
It's human works, right? Everything that dust is about human works. It's not just can you think at all. It's when people started creating art and when people started drawing on things. Like that seems to be the 33,000 line and everything. Like that seems to be what he's sort of, and he's drawing a line between has conscious thought versus uses it to create anything from a meal to, you know, a drawing on the wall. So yeah, maybe monkeys is the right analogy. It just kind of like it bumped me.
Right. And people do eat monkeys some places, but
no,
they don't eat it much. I mean, I think there are health reasons why you're not supposed to eat it too, but like diseases and stuff.
Sure,
but these are big questions. But yeah, it shows that it's like Philip Pullman's world that requires balance does require some choices, if not ethical compromise, then at least big ethical choices that you kind of have to consciously make and like wrestle with.
There's a little bit of animism in here too. There's a little bit of the care that Mulefa take for the roads and the seed pods, and they take care in everything. So there's a little bit of like gratefulness for everything that surrounds them, and treating even inanimate objects, you know, with great care.
Yes, yeah. That's absolutely true.
The trees especially,
mm-hmm.
The life-giving trees that they recognize need their attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's that's another element, right? That it's a Garden of Eden in intentionally Edenic location, mm-hmm. but it's one without a single deity. You know, right. It's not monotheistic.
Yeah. Right. It doesn't even seem to be theistic. It seems to have a lot of, well, maybe it is theistic in a way.
Maybe. I think your sighting of animism is really apt.
They're like Marie Kondo.
Yeah, kind of.
That, honestly, I think thank you to the tree and, right. You know, in a yeah. I like Marie Kondo. Nobody can tell me different about her. Do we have more to say about the Malefa?
I don't think so. I mean, we will have more to say about the Malefa, but I think we covered it from these chapters. I think that's it for Dust Bears. Dust Bunny! All right, so we already mentioned the Lodestone Resonator. It's steampunk Snapchat. It's, well, I don't even know what it is.
Or like SoundCloud.
Yeah, right.
It's totally steampunk SoundCloud.
Yeah, right.
He keeps uploading SoundClouds for Asriel to go listen to.
Yeah, it's like,
go listen.
Have you checked out my demo? While you're there.
Early podcasting by the Galavespians.
Right.
Very high pitched. So the Swiss Guard, I missed this. The Swiss Guard appear?
Yeah, it's very short. They don't even necessarily appear. They're just mentioned. Yeah, they're like, there's the Swiss Guard is boarding the airships to go kill Lyra. And it's like, the Swiss Guard. Swiss Guard really exists. Really do guard the Pope.
They do, and they kill no one. Let's be honest.
No.
There a point at which the Swiss Guard were more vicious?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you would not have wanted to get hit by their pikes in the 16th century.
I wouldn't want to get hit with their pikes now, but
yeah.
I take your meaning.
Yeah, no, they were a formidable fighting force in like the 15, 1600s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. But you know what I read recently is the Swiss Guard, they had largely been, they were an active security force, but they had largely become more and more ceremonial. Obviously the Pope, you know, the Papal lands are no longer caught up in wars, although they actually were for most of European history. They were like, you know, they were a state. So they were like a militarily. Melissa is of Sicilian descent. So she knows how often armies cross and crisscross.
Oh, yes.
Southern Italy. But actually since there was a assassination attempt on John Paul II, I want to say.
Yes.
The Swiss Guard has actually stepped up their training.
Really?
And like hand-to-hand combat and small arms training and like tactical defense and like all like making, becoming more of like a special forces group.
While wearing very funny pants.
Right. Because there's actually like, oh shit, we actually have to like be able to defend somebody.
Yes.
In this age of global terrorism. And I, that probably had something to do with it too.
I would imagine. That was in like the 80s, I think, that John Paul II.
Yeah, late 80s,
yeah,
I want to say.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the tuilapi.
Tuilapi, evil birdos.
I can't help but think of tilapia. Do you think of tilapia?
Of course I think of tilapia.
Freaking tilapia.
I know.
But you know what they also remind me of? The bird from Finding Nemo. The birds in Finding Nemo who are trying to eat all the fish.
Oh, the mine? The seagulls?
Mine, the seagulls. Yeah, yeah.
Totally.
What do you think they represent? And what do they represent in this kind of circle?
I think it's complicated because I think that, you know, they could represent like what's threatening the world and like everything's out of balance and these predatory evil birds. And yeah, the fact that they don't just steal all the food, but they also like wreck everything is like, that suggests they're probably just bad. But I don't know, if you told the story from the point of view of the fish, that the Malefa fish, they would probably say the same thing about the Malefa.
Right.
Like, we're just swimming around trying to live our lives and they take us and they eat us and they kill us.
Yeah. I mean,
so I don't know.
It is very strange that they crap on everything. Like that's,
that's
not an act of we're predators and we're looking for food. That's an act of actual defecation, defacing. That's an actual like,
yeah, right.
Hateful act.
Yeah.
So there's something more in them. They may have Sraf. They may have consciousness. They do communicate with Father Gomez later a little.
They're a real mystery.
They might just be representative of evil.
They could just be. Like, that seems too simple, but that could be it. They're just, they're an evil force.
There's always evil in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that maybe they're new and they're like a manifestation of like the lack of balance that's coming into the world.
Right. Or that they haven't really been affected by the changes, but whereas it used to be sort of a balance that you could survive that attack, no problem. There's plenty of seed pods, but now they have to worry about the seed pods. And when they throw them into the sea, that's a real problem now, and it didn't used to be.
Right. And also that these birds don't take care of themselves. Like, they gain by stealing. Mm-hmm. They don't, you know, they don't have...
They don't create anything of themselves on their own.
Yeah. The Malefa fish, and the Malefa have, like, animal husbandry, and they grow some food. But these birds, I mean, we only see this one raid, so, like, we don't really know, but it seems like they just prey on other creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they might just be very simply just...
Just evil.
Evil.
The cloud coming out of the sea.
Yeah. But
I guess.
Yeah, but the cloud coming out of the sea is...
It doesn't mean evil.
Right. It means, like...
It could have multiple...
The power of God, yeah.
It could have multiple iterations.
It could. And like you said, he does like a double meaning where one of those meanings is, like, very literal.
Very, very literal. There's happening. Something coming out of the water.
Yeah.
Run. Lithiometer.
Lithiometer, yeah. So, Melissa, what are your lithiometer symbols?
I'm going to choose the two that are very similar, the beehive and the crucible.
Uh-huh.
The beehive for the industrious work that Mary's doing, for the industrious work that the Gallivespians are doing, for the slow plodding across the earth that Will and Yorick are doing, the careful looking out of the knife that Yorick's doing. Everybody's working real hard. And then crucible is achieved knowledge from that work, and that's Mary. That's all Mary. She's really putting in the hours. And Thunderbolt, I chose the Thunderbolt for the piece of inspiration she gains about the Sraf, or the oil, or whatever you want to call it, in this chapter, and her place in the world.
Yeah.
Very quick.
I love it. Yeah. So I picked the beehive for very similar reasons. I mean, it's just the Malefa, they're an industrious little bunch just doing their work and this very Protestant vision of harmony. Everyone's just laboring and, you know, being frugal, and it's wonderful. I picked the owl for Father Gomez.
Interesting.
Yeah, just like stalking in the night unseen, you know, this predator. Owls are usually seen as, you know, more positive symbols, not in Twin Peaks, I guess, but the owls are not what they seem. Yeah, I just feel he's like stalking unseen, unlooked for, like slowly getting closer to his prey.
Nice.
And then I picked the ant for Will, who is just moving across the earth diligently, you know. Will and Yorick both are just, they're simple folk with a simple, not a simple task, but like one straightforward task, and they're just working diligently towards it.
Yeah.
Just crawling across the face of the earth.
We must walk like insects across the face of the earth, like Lee says.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's get our extra award in here. Who's yours?
Oh, man. Mine's Angelica.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. He killed your brother, or like he quote unquote killed your brother. I just feel like there's more nuance here.
And like that, he killed your brother. Sorry. Little West Side Story comes out.
Yeah. I mean, she's just consumed with rage, and she's just a lot. That's all I have to say about Angelica.
Mine's the birds.
Yeah, yeah.
Again,
obviously.
Again, like, you destroyed the thing, you got to crap on it too. What is happening there? Talk about extra. That's like a very extra act.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Especially because they don't have like running water. They can't just like hose it off.
No.
Like,
but
ruins everything.
It takes some pre-thought and pre-planning. Very extra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really. All right. So, no mixtape this week.
Getting back into the swing.
Yeah,
stretching our limbs, getting big in. Hey, we're back, and we can't wait to finish this journey with you and then move into whatever the next thing is, which we will let you know as soon as we know it. So we've got about 18 more chapters of this book. No, sorry, 28 more chapters of this book. We'll probably do a little bit of wrap up and stick with us.
And you know what else they can do?
For the first time in a long time.
Stay
extra.